All right, good evening to everyone. Welcome to The Law and The Law Part 4, sponsored as always by Becky and Avi Katz. Tonight we'll be looking at the case of Brown versus Topeka, Kansas Board of Education and the Torah's views on race and equality. So that's a hot topic. Race relations have always been one of the most vexing issues in American life. It troubled the drafters of the Constitution, and slavery divided the nation and then sparked the deadliest war in American history. And even after slavery was outlawed, the pursuit of normalization and equality and harmony between whites and blacks preoccupied Americans and preoccupies Americans really until today. Even though you think it should be put to rest, it hasn't. So the landmark case that officially put an end to much of segregation and spurred the integration of blacks into society was this case of Brown versus Topeka, Kansas Board of Education. But to understand the case, we have to return to the founding document of the United States, and that's, of course, the Constitution. Everything flows from there. The founders were embroiled in disputes over the existence of slavery and the status of slaves. Of course, most of the South relied for slaves on their economy. Most of the North did not. It was more industrialized. And that point delayed the drafting and the ratification of the Constitution for a long time until they came up with what was a compromise at the time in Article 1 of Section 2. I quote, "Representatives and direct taxes," so forget taxes for a moment, "but representatives," meaning the House, "shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers." The question is, who's to be counted as a citizen? "Which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons." This was the famous 3/5 compromise, that black slaves would be counted as 3/5 of a person for the purpose of the census and apportioning representation in Congress. Now, it's almost counterintuitive, and it's not widely known, but the 3/5 compromise was suggested by the anti-slavery North, not the pro-slavery South, despite the racist overtones. It wasn't meant actually to demean blacks, almost the exact opposite. The North didn't want to have thousands of black slaves counting in the census of the South and yet not being able to vote or influence policy when they're not truly free. So if they couldn't be citizens, they did not want them counting in the census. It's a point not well understood. If the full number of blacks had been fully counted, then the South would have benefited politically from the numbers without giving them any rights. And for sure, it would have guaranteed the continuation of slavery for many decades without all the controversies of the 19th century. All those controversies only arose because the North had greater representation in Congress than the South, because the blacks were not fully counted, and other reasons. So the 3/5 compromise actually strengthened those who wanted to end slavery, however it sounds. This notion of partial citizenship for blacks was reinforced by the infamous decision in Dred Scott versus Sanford in 1857. Dred Scott had been a slave who had been taken by his master to a few states to live, including Missouri, who was a free state, where he lived for some time. There, in fact, Dred Scott married legally, even though slaves in the South were not allowed to marry legally. There, when he left and went to Louisiana, he sued for his freedom on the grounds that his residence in a free state had guaranteed his free status. Dred Scott lost. Again, note the year, 1857, just 4 years before the Civil War broke out. And before the Supreme Court, his claims were rejected. The Supreme Court ruled that Scott had no standing to sue, since he was not a citizen of any state. Only a citizen can sue in federal court. And on the substance, Chief Justice Roger Taney, who was a 7-2 decision, ruled that the drafters of the Constitution deemed blacks to be, and I quote from the decision, "beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race. either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. That was the decision. Two things were accomplished by the decision. One, the court had spoken and reaffirmed the constitutional vision of black rights, and two, the Civil War became inevitable because there was going to be no relief for black slaves through the legal system. In any event, the Three-Fifths Compromise was repealed by the 14th Amendment after the war, when blacks were then counted the same as whites. Non-taxpaying Indians were still excluded. And the Equal Protection Clause, that's Clause 1 of the 14th Amendment, guaranteed all citizens the equal protection of the laws of the United States, and included blacks as well. Nonetheless, the question remained, just what exactly does equal mean in equal protection? So this was a most contentious issue then and now. Does equal mean exactly the same? Does it mean, and this is controversy today, but I mean literally today, equality of result or just equality of opportunity? Meaning, must everybody have the same opportunity to prosper, to succeed, to apply for employment, etc.? Or must there be some guaranteed equality of result, all right? Those who maintain that equality means equality of result are much more inclined to complain about what's called now the income inequality in American life. If it's income inequality, it means the results somehow are not match some preconceived notion of what equal should be. So all of this was caught up in the turbulence that followed the Civil War, after which black slaves became citizens, but their citizenship clashed with the cultural mores and biases that still pervaded the South. The Civil War ended the fighting, but it didn't end the struggle. The 14th Amendment guaranteed equal protection of the laws, but that's not necessarily the same as equal treatment in the society. Which brings us first to Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. So this 1896 case is best known for two things. One, it was directly reversed by Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. And secondly, two, for bequeathing to American life the phrase, separate but equal. This was the case. Louisiana had passed a law regarding the accommodations in public transport, like railroads, providing separate rail cars for whites and blacks. A group of citizens wanted to challenge the law as discriminatory and asked Homer Plessy to test it. Plessy was an interesting choice because he was took place in New Orleans. He was from New Orleans and mostly a French background, with a paternal grandfather who had married a black woman in Haiti. So in fact, Plessy was 1/8 black, only 1/8 black, identifying himself as a French Creole. In June 1892, Plessy bought a ticket and boarded a train in New Orleans, sat in a white compartment, and was challenged by the conductor, who noticed Plessy's slightly dark complexion, because he was just a little off-white. Now, apparently, there are reports like this, the railroad company was told in advance about Plessy's lineage, because he and the others were testing the law, and they wanted to make this case. Otherwise, he could have passed very easily as a white in the white compartment. In any event, Plessy was escorted off the train, he was arrested, he was tried, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to pay a $25 fine. Plessy sued on two grounds in federal court, violations of the 13th and 14th Amendments. Ferguson was the trial judge who convicted him. In 1896, the Supremes ruled 7-1 that Plessy was wrong, and he upheld his conviction. So Plessy had argued that the policy is a continuation of slavery, and the court rejected that. There's no slavery here. There's no 13th Amendment violation. And the court said, a statute which implies merely a legal distinction between the white and colored races, a distinction which is founded in the color of the two races, and which must always exist so long as white men are distinguished from the other race by color, has no tendency to destroy the legal equality of the two races or reestablish a state of involuntary servitude. So in fact, the mere fact is there's a separate compartment does not equate to slavery. But nor did the court find any equal protection violation under the 14th Amendment. And I quote again, laws permitting or even requiring their separation in places where they are liable to be brought into contact do not necessarily imply the inferiority of either race to the other, and have been generally, if not universally, recognized as within the competency of the state legislatures in the exercise of their police power. The most common instance of this, and this is why it led to Brown, is connected with the establishment of separate schools for white and colored children, which has been held to be a valid exercise of the legislative power even by the courts of states where the political rights of the colored race have been longest and most earnestly enforced. And the court specifically ruled it constitutional to establish, I quote, separate schools for children of different ages, sexes, and colors, and that they might also establish special schools for poor and neglected children. But to be asked to sit in a particular car does not deprive any person, white or black, of any property. Again, I quote, we consider the underlying fallacy of the plaintiff's argument to consist in the assumption that the enforced separation of the two races stamps the colored race with a badge of inferiority. If this be so, it is not by reason of anything found in the act, but solely because the colored race chooses to put that construction upon it. The argument also assumes that social prejudice, the previous point was that if it's deemed to be inferior, it's because they choose to see it as inferior. If a train has 10 cars and 5 are for whites, 5 are for blacks, there's no inequality nor any explicit definition of superiority or inferiority. The cars are all part of the same train, going the same direction, heading to the same destination. That was the argument. Now this is another argument which is very interesting. The argument also assumes that social prejudices may be overcome by legislation, and that equal rights cannot be secured to the Negro except by enforced commingling of the two races. We cannot accept this proposition. If the two races are to meet upon terms of social equality, it must be the result of natural affinities, a mutual appreciation of each other's merits, and a voluntary consent of individuals. Further, legislation is powerless to eradicate racial instincts or to abolish distinctions based upon physical differences, and the attempt to do so can only result in accentuating the difficulties of the present situation. It's very interesting because even now, so many years after all these decisions, and when America is essentially a very heterogeneous society, there's even a precedent of mixed race. The fact is, as many people pointed out, the most segregated time in America is Sunday morning, because blacks and whites generally worship separately in separate churches by their own volition. There are very few churches that are almost completely mixed. People choose to pray with their own. And just like we see in neighborhoods, it's the same way. People tend to live more with others with whom they share some cultural affinity. So you may not be able to exclude anyone. That's a different issue. But left to our own devices, people will generally choose to live where they want to live, with whom they most feel comfortable. And that's the point. Social prejudices cannot be overcome by legislation, and it need not even be social prejudice that bring it about. It's simply a sense of comfort. That's why we cluster in neighborhoods. And that's why the blacks do, and the Chinese do, and the Hispanics do, and everyone else in the society. They tend to establish neighborhoods until they move out, and when they move out, they tend to also cluster together again in the future. The court concluded, if the civil and political rights of both races be equal, one cannot be inferior to the other civilly or politically. If one race be inferior to the other socially, the Constitution of the United States cannot put them upon the same plane. Plessy versus Ferguson held that there is no possibility, at least at that point, that there should be the identical treatment of races. Thus was born the doctrine of separate but equal. as long as equal facilities are provided to all races, the fact that the facilities are separate does not violate the Constitution. Here, the trains were separate. The schools were separate. But as long as they're trains, as long as they're schools educating both races or all races, it should not violate the Constitution. I mentioned Plessy was decided by a 7-1 vote. The dissent was John Marshall Harlan, in a very famous dissent, and in words that would presage a decision in Brown almost 60 years later. Harlan wrote, "The white race deems itself to be the dominant race in this country. And so it is in prestige, in achievements, in education, in wealth, and in power. So I doubt not it will continue to be for all time if it remains true to its great heritage and holds fast to the principles of constitutional liberty. But in view of the Constitution, in the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior, dominant, ruling class of citizens. There is no class here. Our Constitution is colorblind." And that will be a phrase that will echo for this next century after that, down to our day. "Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law. The humblest is the peer of the most powerful. The law regards man as man and takes no account of his surroundings or of his color when his civil rights is guaranteed by the supreme law of the land are involved." So said Justice Harlan. It is true, it's a very powerful statement, there is no caste system in America, and the humblest is the peer of the most powerful. So when I was reading this, I just thought to myself, just look at the presidency, for example. The presidency has been an amalgam of people from very, very poor origins, wealthy origins, and something in between. Obama is one of the rare presidents who actually comes from a middle-class background, notwithstanding the mixed race. The Bushes obviously came from wealth. Reagan and Nixon were dirt poor. Came from extremely poor families. Nixon didn't have shoes until he was 8 years old. He was going to class barefoot. If you just trace the history of the presidency, some came from wealth, like the Roosevelts, and others came from nothing, like Truman and dozens of others. So there's no caste system, which of course is completely the antithesis of Europe and in most countries around the world. Here, you get by on merit or the good advice of your political handlers. Now, Arlen ended, "The thin disguise of, in quotation marks, equal accommodations for passengers in railroad coaches will not mislead anyone nor atone for the wrong this day done." Plessy's long-term consequence was the strengthening socially and legally of the segregation laws across the South, the so-called Jim Crow laws, Jim Crow being the name of a caricature of blacks that was performed by whites in the entertainment industry. It's meant as a pejorative. Fast forward now to the 40s and 50s. Oliver Brown was a black welder, and he became the public face of a class action suit to compel the Topeka, Kansas Board of Education to allow black students to attend the white-only public school in Topeka. Now, there were five such cases pending before the court, but Brown became the name on the case primarily because the court did not want a case from the South. There was a case from Carolina, a case from Virginia, but Kansas, like right in the middle of the country, blend in, they're not identified as North or South. That should be the case of record. And the facts were simple. Brown's 8-year-old daughter had to walk 6 blocks to a bus that would then take her to a black school a mile away when the white school was just a 7-block walk from their home. It's very interesting. A few points. The Topeka middle schools and Topeka high schools were already integrated. Only the elementary schools were not, and that was the subject of the suit. Also, the case was first argued in early 1953, but no decision was reached among the justices. Felix Frankfurt, who was again the Jewish judge on the court at the time, wanted unanimity in order to deal a death blow to segregation, But when the case was first heard, he didn't find it. One obstacle was Chief Justice Vinson and other justices who felt that overruling Plessy would be improper judicial activism. Some judges, until today, feel, not wrongly, that if change has to be made in society, it should come from the legislatures. That's how democracy operates, rather than fiat from the judges. And this is a matter for the states to work out, and not for the court to impose. So the case was just stagnant for months. Frankfurter asked for re-argument in the fall, and he got it. One of the lawyers, of course, who argued the case was the then chief counsel of the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall, became the first black Supreme Court justice in the 60s. But before the re-argument, and it's interesting how these things happen, Vinson was retired by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He shed his earthly coil, let's say he died, and he was replaced by Earl Warren, who was the governor of California, and Warren had already integrated the California school system with Mexican Americans. Over the course of several months, Warren won the unanimity that was sought by drafting and revising the opinion numerous times until everybody would sign on, and in fact everyone signed on in the end. Plessy was overturned 9-0, and segregation in schools was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. The court noted the general changes in formal education, in black achievement, none of the harsh rhetoric of the Dred Scott decision, all the changes in American life since 1868 and the Equal Protection Clause, and certainly since Plessy. And Warren, who wrote the decision, narrowed the issue, framed it perfectly for his purposes. He asked, "The segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does. We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. Therefore, we hold that the plaintiffs and others similarly situated whom the actions have been brought are, by reason of the segregation complained of, deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment." So spoke the court. Of course, very little was resolved practically, and the case had to be remanded for the litigants to deal with the details, where the devil always resides. Desegregating the schools was more easily pronounced by the court than done, and the court was forced to adopt and compelled communities to adopt policies such as forced busing, which became the primary tool used to integrate schools, with all its own problems. It's the case of Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education, 1971, specifically endorsed busing in order to achieve racial balance. That is to say, northern schools were largely integrated before Brown, but southern schools, and later the northern ones in black and white neighborhoods, you know, the same issue here in Teaneck 20 years ago, were ordered to send children great distances from their homes in order to achieve what was called racial balance. Otherwise, the schools could have maintained segregation simply by claiming that they were full. So what sounds great in theory, racial balance was often disastrous in practice. By the 70s, both blacks and whites opposed forced busing in very large numbers. More than 90% in polls opposed it, because there were a few unintended consequences. First, it generated white flight out of the cities to the suburbs, far from black neighborhoods, and made parts of America even more segregated than before. And it was a terrible hardship to children who became pawns, shuttled about different parts of the cities because of their skin color, white or black, matching whatever the demographic needed, and involved the courts in matters best left and best handled locally. Like all contentious issues in which the court meddles too much, it had to be revisited again and again, and Swan was substantially modified by Milliken versus Bradley in 1974, to 5-4 decision that held that busing could take place only where there is definitive evidence of deliberate segregation. And by the early 2000s, forced busing was largely abandoned. But the repeal of separate but equal also had other unintended consequences. Remember, Harlan in Plessy versus Ferguson spoken of a colorblind constitution. Well, affirmative action, we'll take up separately in a few weeks, would greatly contest that concept. And here's the broader question. Is separate always unequal? Categorically, why should that be? So I remember myself in the early 1990s, Detroit, which has been a churban now since the 60s, pioneered all-black public schools for boys to try to better educate them by giving them black role models and better discipline in all-black schools, separated from whites and separated from girls. That was a big controversy. In the end, it was approved. So they exist. Those schools exist. But they also have been opposed. They've always been opposed by the hardcore equalists that came out of Brown. Or how about same-sex schools, all boys or all girls? Those should also be nominally unconstitutional in a secular setting. But in the last two decades, if not more, I think in the parts of the country it was always like this, they've always been permitted. And many educators have seen, I'll say it's an open question maybe, girls excel more at math and science, for example, when they're not in the class with boys, and they don't have to be ashamed to speak up. And boys learn better generally, depending on age and other factors, when they're educated separately, they don't have to impress boys. Should that be legal? Can that be legal? Should parents have the option to create such schools if a particular district agrees? Why not? Nonetheless, the Brown absolutists have always been opposed to such innovations. Has education suffered? I'll leave that as an open question. And we get back to our main point. What does the Torah have to say about all this? Well, you'll find even in recent times, there's some Brown-like controversies that have erupted in Israel. The most recent flare-up of this conundrum has been in the separate sex buses in Israel, separate seating for men and women, men in the front of the bus, women in the back of the bus, the Mahadran buses. So women have protested, or some women have protested, some women like it. And there was even a Jewish Rosa Parks who forced herself to be arrested. Rabbi Warburg, our own Rabbi Warburg, wrote recently that halacha would justify such a setup. Even liberals should support it, even if the Torah does not mandate it. Now, to me, frankly, the issue is more economics than it is moral. Eged was faced with a situation where if it did not accommodate the Haredi population's wishes, they would simply set up their own transportation system, in which case Eged would lose half its riders in cities like Yerushalayim. So simply put, it was a business trying to accommodate its customers. As long as there are mixed buses available, and one has the option to wait for the next bus, if you don't want to sit separate, I don't see any big problem with it. But the Israeli courts, which always try to mimic the American courts, recently held, the last week or two, that such an arrangement is illegal in Israel. The High Court said you cannot have it, and there cannot be any type of government recognized separation on the buses. It has to be privately run. So in fact, I just saw this yesterday, of the 2,108 bus lines in Israel, 56 are deemed Mahadrim, which is a small percentage. So again, Haredim have the same choice. If they feel so strongly about not sitting on a bus with women or with men, they could wait for one of those 56 buses traversing the country to come their way. But again, here's the main problem. It sounds great in theory. But the practicality of it is, if now they decide to go ahead, the Haredi community, and start their own private bus service, so Eged suffers. And they'll essentially go to biz in Yerushalayim, because the bus, the Haredim, will compete and just overwhelm them. Or there was such another case where the court can act and philosophize, but the reality on the ground does not catch up to their decision. Or is the episode, the shameful episode in Emmanuel? Emmanuel is a settlement in the Shomron. Happened first, I think, two, 3 years ago. It's happened again last year. In one of the schools there, Sephardic girls were separated from Ashkenazic girls in the same school. He even built a wall within the campus itself so the students could not even eat lunch together. Now the media just followed the familiar American narrative, and they said it was because of the skin color. The Sephardic girls are darker, the Ethiopian girls are darker, and the Ashkenazic parents wanted only a school for whites. A lot of parents protested. I remember seeing this myself on television, including some Ethiopians and Sephardic parents, because even in the so-called white school, there were Ethiopian and Sephardic children, and they said the issue was not skin color, but the presence of televisions in the homes of the others and the accompanying bad influence. So a wall seems a little much. Even if those homes are defiled by televisions, that should be part of the educational system, how to deal with such phenomena in life. But nonetheless, the familiarity of the racial discrimination meme is one of the legacies of Brown, and it just permeates so much in cultures of every democracy. Well, what does the Torah in fact say about equality, about race? Clearly, race is not a defining characteristic for Jews, something which confused the Nazis. Jews are a religio nation, and that religio nation, as Rav Hirsch called it, is defined by ideas, not race. So Jews come in all races and colors and shapes and sizes. Even blood is not a determinant of Jewishness, only halacha is. And we maintain, Mishnah says in Avos, man is precious because he was created in the image of God. Man was given him a special favor that God informed him of his status, being created in God's image. So God created different races of people, the common denominator that we were all created in his image. Chazal say famously, Rabbi Kiva said, "B'hafer chokamocha, should love your neighbor as yourself." Zeh kol gadol b'Torah, the Yerushalmi Nedarim, we have it as well in Bereishis Rabbah, in Chav Dalet, Ben Azai Omer, Zeh Sefer Toldos Adam, Zeh kol gadol b'Torah. The fact that man was created, the Pasuk ends, but it's created at Zel Melokim, that is the kol gadol b'Torah. That every human being is created in God's image. That's even greater, Ben Azai said, than the notion of Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha. Because in fact what he means is that the idea of the Tzel Elokim Baros is the framework by which we'll love others. We love others because we see them as fellow creatures of God. The Torah recognizes and endorses the notion that society has to be founded upon basic principles of equality. Mishpat Echad Yelochem Kager Kazrach. Whether one is a resident or a non-resident, mishpat echad. In terms of the judicial system, everyone is treated the same. And one could search in vain for any statement in Jewish literature that particular races are superior or inferior. The Gemara always speaks about certain locales or countries that were stereotyped for certain behaviors, but it's not based on race. So that white Jews and black Jews and brown Jews and Oriental Jews and all part of the Am Hanivchar. Rav Nachsholi Bar Ilan writes in his Mishtar Umdina Al Pi HaTorah, inequality in society impairs the dignity of every individual, arouses hatred and jealousy within the society, encourages disrespect for the law, induces government corruption, and is the Chil Hashem. And as we know, could even help the enemy. Some of you may remember Muhammad Ali refused induction into the service in the late 1960s in order to avoid going to Vietnam. And Ali said, as only he could, "I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong. No Viet Cong ever called me," and he used the N-word. Meaning his problems were in America. He had no problems with the Vietnamese. So you see, the legacy of racism is such that it leaves a person even less patriotic, less with less affinity for his own country. That's what the Torah says. But. There's a but. The elephant in the room is that many Christians justify slavery itself because of the Bible. Even claiming, you see, the literature in the 19th century was replete with this. It's God's will that there be slaves. And the Torah accedes to the institution of slavery. So how could Evid Kanani, forget the Evid Ivri. It's more of an indentured servant to pay for debt. Evid Kanani. So how can the Torah espouse pure notions of equality? So for Jews it's one thing, but here we're talking about an outsider. And it's obvious that in the Torah, equality does not mean sameness. Not everybody's treated the same. Different people have different obligations. So we should be able to actualize, so that we should be able to actualize our destiny as the Mamlechas Kohen and V'gai Kadosh. The Torah assigns different roles and obligations to the Jew and the non-Jew, to men and women, to a Talmud Chacham, to an Am Haaretz, to a resident or to an alien, to a Kohen, to a Levi Yisrael. There really is no equality in that sense, as we would like to think. Rav Nevinsol put it like this. He said, Judaism waves the banner of Achdus, of unity, but lo kol shaveh ba'olamo shel HaBoreh. Not everyone is equal in God's world, nor everything. Aval hakol meuchad v'shoeif lo'oto matarah mishutefet shekavalo HaBoreh. Not everything is equal in God's world, such in the sense that a mathematician would use the word equal, but everyone should be united. Everyone should strive for the same objectives that God ordained. It's more like, as Rav Dessler says in a different context, like an orchestra. The wind and the brass are not equal. Instead of equal, they're different roles. They're part of the same orchestra. The third baseman and the pitcher are also important, but not equal. They're different roles. Even different rules apply to them. The quarterback and the lineman also have different rules. You wouldn't say it's a gross inequality. You're just saying they're playing different roles in the same system. That's how we perceive the world as well. Thus, when the Declaration of Independence states boldly that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, as noble and as inspirational as these sentiments are, they're not completely accurate, much less self-evident, unless they're defined. So by what measure are all men created equal? By the way, when they wrote it, they certainly had blacks in mind, nor for that matter they had women in mind. They said all men are created equal, but even that was not so. But how are we created equal? We don't all look the same. We don't have the same talents or capabilities or backgrounds or family origins. There's nothing equal about the way we're created. And not all rights accrue to all people at all times. Rav Menashe Klein in the Mishnah Halachos, in Chelek Tes, Simon Shin Yud, he had the most brazen approach to Jefferson's words, and he said the contention that all men are created equal is Kfira Gemura B'Torasenu HaKadosha, the Sheker Muchlot. He said it's total heresy. It's a total denial of our holy Torah, and it's a complete falsehood. It's not true. And he said only the Rishon B'Demokratia, they're the ones who believe such a thing. He said God made boundaries, parameters. Kasav the Torah, Hagbel es Sahar v'Kidash Tov, make boundaries around our Sinai, sanctify it. Gvulim Osak HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God made a world with boundaries. It's a little strong, but we can agree that among the rights that all men have, whether or not we're created equal, are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Rav Kook wrote in Ein Ayah, in Brachas, in the first volume, that when it comes to the fundamentals of life and basic needs, Ein Hevdel Beino Bein Zulah, so there's no difference between one person and another, whether Jew or non-Jew. But there is a difference between discrimination and distinctions. They're two separate words. The former has a negative connotation, the latter, not so bad. You can't treat everyone the same. Just because you give money to the poor doesn't mean you give money to the rich. You have to treat people differently. People have different needs, different expectations. There has to be equality within the groups. But each individual group need not be treated the same. Of course, the group should be informed of any inequality. The Chasam Sofer writes in his commentary on this week's Seder Vayeshev, that was Yaakov's mistake, that he failed to explain to his sons why Yosef was singled out for special treatment. Yaakov did it because he was a greater chacham, was ben zkunim, bar chokim lei. They didn't see Yosef as any greater chacham than they were, so therefore they protested. You have to let them know. But here's the key point. Where the Torah obviously differs is that the groups we have in Jewish life and outside, as we look at the rest of the world, they're distinguished based on status or some rational condition, like sex or tribe or intellectual attainments or moral aspirations. No distinctions are based on differences that are as frivolous as skin color. It's like distinguishing people between height and weight, although truth be told, they do that in professional basketball and football. It's behavior in terms of chachma umaisim that matters most. So the Torah views race as a bizarre criterion by which to segregate people. Thus, in the matter at hand, education, so obviously the Torah endorses separate educational systems for Jews and non-Jews. But for Jews, would everything that Jews need a separate educational system? It's one Torah. Is it appropriate to separate Ashkenazim and Sfardim? It's a good question. I could make a cogent argument why they should not be separated at all. It's one Torah. Either different poskims, let everyone learn each other's poskim. It's all Talmud Torah. And in terms of Psak Halach, I'll find out what to do. The real problem was in Tefillah, because of different nuschos. In Israel, it's somewhat fudged. It's a little different, though. Many Sardim are insistent that the children follow the customs of their fathers, Ashkenazim as well. It's not as easily handled, except Minyanim also. But to categorically say that any group of Jews should not be able to learn with another group, that would be anathema to the Torah world. Now, there's a long-standing argument whether the Torah supported slavery l'chatchila as a worthy and necessary institution, or b'dieved, simply as a concession to the times, because the world of Jews that accepted the Torah was one where slavery was rampant and even necessary. What's clear, though, is that the Torah's institution of slavery was completely different from that of the South, the American South. The Eved Kanani, for example, could marry, he could purchase his own freedom, he had to be fed and treated like part of the household, not live in a shack like they had on the plantations. He could not be physically abused, and most tellingly, the Eved Kanani had to observe all the mitzvahs except those that is man groma. That's what we say, bracha shlo asani oved, because he became almost a quasi-Jew. So the Torah's, and if he was freed, he became a full Jew. The Torah's slavery was essentially an attempt to take uncivilized pagans and mainstream them. Especially the Canaanim were the enemy at the time. If they lived with a family, a normal family, and they saw the morality and holiness and goodness of that family, it would influence them for the good. Eventually they'd be Jewish. That's not slavery as it existed in the South. Indeed, that becomes a compelling Torah argument for the welfare of the non-Jew in the Torah state. The Rambam, for example, praises Avram for publicizing the true ideas of God. That's also part of life. So we don't want to distance even non-Jews in the Torah state. And our Hirsch writes in Chorev that a Jew in the world is like the Kohen amongst the Jewish people themselves. And since, as Rav Kook wrote about us, that the very future of the Jewish people is always tied to Chinuch, it's short-sighted to slight those who are different from us and provide them with an inferior education. We also have to bear in mind that in the Torah state and in the world at large, there's a difference between the way citizens and non-citizens are treated. If not, there'd be no reason to have such a concept as citizen. So I'm always dismayed when I hear people pontificating about the rights of Arabs in Yudan Shomron, what the Jews have. They don't have what the Jews have. Well, the former are not citizens of the state of Israel, so they shouldn't have the same rights. Of course, basic rights must be provided, but the Torah state, like all states, is allowed, if not obligated, to preserve its cultural and spiritual heritage. Our Bar Ilan cited a Professor Yechezkel Dror, who said that Jews should always be at least 80% of the population of the Jewish state, or its Jewish character is in danger. Kuzari, in the first Maimer, is discussing with the king of the Khazars the Mesorah, and the king says to him, so the Torah is only given to you. So he replies in Os Chav Zayin, Omra Chavar Kenu, the Torah is given to us, but not only to us. V'chol hanilva eleinu min ha'umos, b'frat yagi'eu min ha'tov ha'sha'yetiv ha'bor eleinu. Whoever joins us genuinely from the nations of the world, they can partake of the same good that we have. Doesn't mean conversion necessarily, just if they want to be part of the nation of Israel, even to live in the nation of Israel, but supportive of the Jewish people. Ach lo yeshaveh imanu. If they don't convert, they're not the same, they're not equal to us. Listen to this. Ve'ilu hoyechiv ator mepnei shebranu. If the obligations of the Torah devolve only upon those whom God created, or because He created us, the white man and the black man would also be equal and have the Torah too. Ki hakol briosav, because God created everyone, Jews, whites, and blacks. Achatora mipnei shotzionu min Israel. But the Torah is specifically for us because God took us out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt. And He attached His glory to us because we're considered, we're called to be the treasured people from all of mankind. The differences that we have in the Torah are never racial. They're always religious. That's to say, they're founded upon ideas. So, the Gemara Shabbos says, in Kuf Yud Testament Beis, L'chor Yerushalayim, Ela B'Shvil Shehushu Katon V'Gadol. Yerushalayim was destroyed because they started to equate great people and not great people. Meaning there's no greatness, the Marsha says. If you have no concept of greatness, because everybody's treated the same way, you can't sustain a society like that. You can't equate ever categorically the treatment of the great and the less great. So Brown was and is an historic decision, but it might have overreached. It spoke in absolutes. Separate is always unequal. But in order to eradicate any legal or moral justification for racial segregation, and I recognize that, in schools, and as it was applied later in transportation, in restaurants, water fountains, etc. But it just assumed that separate schools must by definition discriminate, and that blacks in separate schools were being deemed inferior. That might not necessarily be so. For sure, Brown attempted to solve one problem, endemic racism, by creating others, and even spawned a series of future decisions that would render the Constitution not colorblind, but partial to blacks. How that happened, affirmative action, for example, we'll discuss at a future date. But one of the gifts of the Jewish people to the world was the idea emerging from the Torah that all of God's creatures were created B'Tzelem Elokim and all deserve His favor and the kindness and support and the fair treatment of His other creatures. I thank you all very much. Next week, just needed a bang. Next week, in Yonah Deyoma, a holiday season is upon us, so we'll look at the case of Lemon versus Kurtzman and the Torah's perspective on religion in the public sphere. Thank you very much.